Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to the science writer, Kitty Ferguson. Kitty Ferguson was born in San Antonio, Texas. She now divides her time between South Carolina and Cambridge. An experienced science writer, her previous books include The Fire in the Equations, Measuring the Universe, The Nobleman and His House Dog, and Stephen Hawking, Quest for a Theory of Everything. Kitty's latest book is Pythagoras, His Lives and the Legacy of a Rational Universe. I'm talking to Kitty Ferguson. Kitty, thank you for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Thank you.
So we're going to be talking about Pythagoras, His Lives and the Legacy of a Rational Universe, which is, well, it's ostensibly a biography of Pythagoras, but right at the beginning, you say that everything that can be known, literally, about the historical figure of Pythagoras, you can write in one paragraph, which you then do. So you've set yourself up quite a difficult task to write a longer biography there.
So we have so little evidence and such a great legacy. You know, how can that be? And I think the answer to that is that the very lack of evidence has allowed a really interesting story to emerge. It has allowed generation after generation to recreate Pythagoras, to reinvent him, to make a myth of him, to make an anathema of him in times, to make off-the-wall claims about him. A little bit the way composers in music write variations on a theme. And in Pythagoras' case, we have variations by Plato, we have variations by Kepler, Cicero, Bertrand Russell, Louisa May Alcott, the heroes of the French Revolution, and even scientists today who are looking for samples of or for evidence of extraterrestrial life. And all of them have taken a very slim theme indeed and created intricate variations, some of them off the wall, some of them completely imaginary, but some of them brilliant, such as Kepler's, really, that have contributed hugely to the wealth of human knowledge. And so it's this ongoing, that's what my book covers. I do cover tell as much as can be told about his life and about him, but then I follow these variations through the centuries to the 20th century, and it's sort of ongoing music of Pythagoras. And that's why the publisher chose to call it His Lives and the Legacy, with a nod to reinvention and reincarnation. That's really the source of that. I didn't like that title at first, but then I thought, okay. Yes, I think that anyone thinking they're going to write nonfiction about Pythagoras is taking on a real challenge. And when you ask, how do we separate the myth from the real person? How do we find the real Pythagoras? That is a question you could go back in time and ask to Plato. You could ask Aristotle. You could ask the biographers of the 3rd century AD. You could go on asking that question, and each one of them would say, oh, it's very difficult. And each one made it more difficult for the next generation of people trying to answer those questions. Because all we have of really hard primary, can't even call it that, but primary evidence about Pythagoras are 6 little fragments that come from writers in the century after he died. Some of them, their lives overlapped with his, but in general they're from the century after he died. And we don't even have those books. We have those as little fragments in the works of other authors who may have seen those books or may have gotten them from another secondary source. We have nothing from Pythagoras himself, not a fragment. no saying, no archaeological evidence, nothing like that. When I say no saying, immediately you get into all these sayings that have been attributed to him later. But actually, if you want to be a strict historian, you have to say only these six little fragments. For instance, and this is the sort of thing you get, quote, "And once when he passed a puppy that was being whipped, they say he took pity on it and made this remark, 'Stop, do not beat him, for it is a soul of a dear friend. I recognized it when I heard its voice.'" And that was from Xenophanes of Colophon. And that is our evidence that Pythagoras believed in a doctrine of reincarnation. It's not that Pythagoras left a body of writing about reincarnation or that his immediate followers did. That's the kind of evidence we get. And then we have, for instance, one of the other fragments, quote, "There was among them a man of immense knowledge who had obtained vast wealth of understanding, a master especially of every kind of wise deed," which also can be translated cunning act, "for when he reached out with all his mind, he easily saw each and everything in 10 or 20 human lives." And that was from Empedocles of Acragas. That we take as evidence that Pythagoras claimed he could remember his past lives in reincarnation. That's the sort of information we have. Those little snippets. And that's how we know about the historical Pythagoras. We do know pretty well when he lived, 570 BC to 500 BC, 6th century. We know he was born, we say we know, with good information, that he was born on the island of Samos, the Greek island of Samos, which is just off the coast of Turkey. And I've been there, it's a wonderful, wonderful island. That was where he was born, that's where he grew up. We have stories that he went to Mesopotamia and Egypt, and also that he crossed the Strait of Samos there to study with Thales on the coast of Turkey. But that's much more iffy. And then we know he moved to southern Italy in 530 BC. And that's probably the best established date of all that we have about Pythagoras. About 530, he moved there. That was a Greek colony. And it's, if you want to picture the map of Italy, it's in the instep of the Italian boot, more down toward the toe, toward near to Sicily. That's where he spent 30 years then. That's where we think he did mainly most of his teaching, most of his community leadership, because he was also seemingly a leader in the community. We don't know whether the Pythagoreans actually were part of the ruling bunch or whether they just had influence on that level. But anyway, they had quite a bit of influence. So, but he died or went into exile in 500, about that time. We don't know. There are some stories that he was killed, some stories that he went into exile at Metapontum. And we know that Cicero thought he did, because Cicero made a pilgrimage in the first century BC to Metapontum to visit the house that was supposed to have been lived in by Pythagoras. But that's really all we know. Then we do know that he taught a doctrine of reincarnation. We know that. And from later writings and writers, we can glean that this really was a doctrine in which it was the goal of every human soul to purify the soul, to go beyond the earthly level and rejoin a divine level of immortality from which every human soul was supposed to be sort of a torn-off fragment. And it was meant that everything the Pythagoreans studied, their study, their thought, their philosophy, their investigation of nature and human nature, was all with this goal in mind, all a journey to purify the soul and rejoin the divine level. We also know that they believed in a sort of a unity of the universe. And much of this, you know, comes into modern science. We do base a lot of our scientific method on these very ideas.
That's an interesting point that I wanted to raise next, because although you're talking about what is ostensibly a sort of mystical doctrine that's probably quite typical of the age, that's how people used to think. But then out of that comes this idea that the universe is something that can be sort of studied and understood, and particularly through numbers. But let's talk about where that idea actually came from. How does that happen? Because obviously they're living in a world that has mystical beliefs and superstition. How does that happen that somebody starts to go down that direction?
Because you are putting your finger there on exactly one of the things that we do think we know for certain about Pythagoras and the Pythagoreans, because of sort of figuring out when certain people lived and when they had to have taught somebody this and when they couldn't have taught them that. We do have pretty good reason to think that this was originally a Pythagorean idea. And this was the idea that arose when he and his followers there in Croton, men and women, were studying and experimenting with string lengths on the lyre And it puzzled them, these thoughtful people, why it was that certain combinations of string lengths produced sounds that were beautiful to their ears, and other combinations did not. And in the course of that pondering, they concluded that behind all the confusion and variety and complexity of nature, there are mathematical regularities, and they fit together in a really quite a simple way, a remarkably simple way. In one of the greatest moments of clarity, I would say, in human history, they concluded that all of nature is backed up in that way.
And these are things that they've come to understand. I was going to say discovered, but discovered's not really the right word, because those things, regardless of their intervention, those things were there the background all the time.
That's right. And the tradition has it that they fell to their knees recognizing the rationality of the universe, that the universe is rational, and that it was possible for human beings to get to this, get at it through numbers. This was the huge Pythagorean realization, their huge contribution. And as we know, I mean, men and women have trusted mathematics as a reliable guide to truth about the universe and nature ever since. We've gone a long way on that premise.
One of the other things that's well known about the Pythagoreans is, perhaps this comes out of the fact that it was also a sort of slightly a mystical sort of culty group as well, is this idea of secrecy. I mean, they never wrote anything down, and it seemed like they were almost looking into the sort of the numbers and the science as a sort of mystical ritual, perhaps, if that's the right way to describe it.
I don't know whether they were looking at it that way, really. And their secrecy, too, is a secret. We don't know how secret they really were. We get it from some of Aristotle's students. Mm. We learn that, you know, Pythagoras, from them, the stories are that he went to Croton and immediately gathered people to teach them. He went to the gymnasium to teach the young men. He taught the women, he taught the men. And then we also get the story of secrecy, that everything was kept secret. We don't know whether that was a progression, that for some reason at first they were open and then they were secret. We don't know whether it's a rumor that they were secret or what. But we do have, one of the things that makes it so difficult to write about him and to research him is that it does seem like there's never been another group who has tried so hard to remain secret and succeeded as well as they did and still has had such huge veneration and influence over such a vast period of time. It's really an interesting thing, and that's really what the book is about.
Mm-hmm. That one of the sort of competing stories that you relate is the travels that he had in his formative years, and mm-hmm. you relate how he possibly goes to Egypt and to Babylon. He possibly experiences the religious rituals that are going on there, which is why I was sort of going to bring out this idea of perhaps that might be where the secrecy came from, that they had an idea that they were doing something that was arcane and that was only for the sort of initiate to know, perhaps.
That would probably have been true in Babylon. It's doubtful whether he even would have been allowed. Of course, everybody says, you know, the stories say, oh, he was so brilliant, everybody recognized him as something special, so of course he was accepted to the inner circle of the priests. Well, you know, who knows? Perhaps more likely in Egypt, where he might have been in one of the schools at one of the that the priests had at some of those centers. That's hard to know, and just where he got the secrecy idea. And also, we don't really know that he went those places. Those are stories that people have made up. And other, but you do have to wonder why he wouldn't have gone. It seems, well, one of the pieces of information we have, and we trust fairly well, is that his father was a merchant, had ships and all that. They traveled all over the place. Some say Pythagoras was actually born over in Phoenicia, in that coast, on one of their journeys. So why wouldn't somebody? And also, Samos was a huge center. It was where several trade routes met, ocean-going trade routes, and the trade routes that came across what we now call Turkey. So it made sense that he might have traveled. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not so far-fetched. You have to ask why not. Why shouldn't we not believe it? So
let's talk a little bit more about some of the esoteric stuff. Well, you've talked about the idea of the transmigration of souls that he believed in. But what are the other perhaps quite common myths that people know about Pythagoras is that he had something of an antipathy towards beans.
Yes.
So let's talk about where this comes from.
Oh, we read about that in Aristotle. He thought it was because beans were used as counters in oligarchical elections, and that's all he says about that. I mean, that's ridiculous. But the stories are that Pythagoras may have died because he was being pursued by people and refused to run across a bean field and trample on the young beans. There are some stories that he loved to eat beans, others that he would not eat beans. I mean, this is all sorts of stuff that comes down about him. And also, one of the difficulties is knowing, not so much when you're talking about beans, but when you're talking about any kind of philosophical concepts or anything like that, how much can we say Pythagoras might have discovered, or the Pythagoreans of his time, and how much was Pythagoreans who followed him after his death and followed in that tradition. And then there you get to the division in the among the Pythagoreans, mm-hmm. between the Akousmatici and the Mathematici, because the Mathematici were followers of his who, seemingly the split happened after his death.
Sure.
Although it may have been, some people speculate that he might have in his own lifetime realized that some people wanted a more rote learning kind of thing, and that's what he gave them, and others he gave a much more open idea of, you know, we must make progress, we must make continual discoveries. So this, anyway, this split lasted after his death. We don't know exactly when it originated. The beans were the sort of thing that was that would have been carried forward by the Akousmatici. And they probably would have, if they thought Pythagoras didn't eat beans, they would never have eaten beans. They took everything he said as the divine pronouncement. They believed that knowledge, or the pursuit of knowledge, should stop with his death. It should not move forward. Anything he taught was truth, but beyond that, it should not. Nobody should pursue anything else. And this was a huge division with the Mathematici, who believed that in the Pythagorean tradition, all of this kind of inquiry should be carried forward.
And again, that sort of marks it out almost as if the Akousmatici were following it as a religion, mm-hmm. whereas clearly the Mathematici are the ones that, you know, won that particular battle, because the scientific method and the way that, you know, science has gone on throughout the rest of human history clearly is the way that they went.
That's true. But you can't really say that the difficulty with saying that is that the Mathematici probably also believed everything the Akousmatici did.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they added that we should go forward. But they also believed in all the what they're called the aphorisms, the sayings of Pythagoras. They followed the practices and all of that. And they also believed that Akousmatici were Pythagoreans as well as they were. The Akousmatici, on the other hand, thought the Mathematici were not Pythagoreans. It was one of those really stupid splits that we get into. Yes, we are fortunate, though, that the Mathematici carried along the tradition rather than all the little stuff.
Yeah, that's something of an understatement. You're listening to Little Atoms this week with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Kitty Ferguson about Pythagoras. So, Kitty, perhaps we should have a little look at the Pythagorean theorem, which is the thing that everybody will be familiar with if they've spent any time in school. The Pythagorean theorem, which is this idea that the square on the hypotenuse of a right-angled triangle is equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides. There's actually a debate about whether or not, in fact, probably not even much of a debate anymore,
no,
about whether or not it was actually Pythagoras who first
discovered it. Yes, I do find that a little troubling, because nearly everybody, you know, says, what are you working on now, Kitty, or what are you, my book about Pythagoras. Oh, we know about him, you know, we studied about his theorem in school. And everybody seems sort of proud to know, yes, we know who he is. And I have to say, well, I regret to say that he probably wasn't the first to discover that theorem. It was known, we know now, it was discovered. Actually, our discovery wasn't made until the 20th century. That theorem was known at least 1,000 years before he was born. In the first great era of Babylon, the time of Hammurabi at that time and all that. It's clear that it was, because what we've found is fragments of tablets that show, that have a theorem, and show mm-hmm. them practically using the theorem. And these are not tablets of scholars. They're actually tablets of students. So in other words, it had made it into the textbooks by that time. It was well known. Then the question is, okay, well, does that really knock Pythagoras off the pedestal? Well, we don't really know. It's still very mysterious because, as I say, there were stories that he went and spent several years in Babylon when he was a young man. This would have been in the 6th century B.C., whereas the it was already known in somewhere between 1800 B.C. and 1595 B.C., somewhere in that era. So, but we have to say, if he did go to Babylon, let's say he did, could he have learned it there at that time? Well, most scholars think that there wouldn't have been much left of that ancient knowledge going on in Babylon at the time he was there. But what might very well have survived is a triplet of numbers for the three sides of a right triangle. Triplet of number being 3, 4, and 5.
Mm-hmm.
If you use those as the measurements, you get a right triangle. You don't have to know the theorem to know that, if you just know 3, 4, 5.
But then that would have been used in building and surveying, just practically.
Maybe even in Greece. We don't mm-hmm. have to say it was only used in Mesopotamia. But if that was what Pythagoras picked up, and then used that as a springboard to rediscover the theorem, that's a very believable
mm-hmm.
Sequence of events. On the other hand, it may have been independent discovery. It's the sort of thing, because it's so basic, it's so there, that I'm sure it's probably been rediscovered many times. You know, you hear stories of people who grew up maybe in Russia at a time when textbooks weren't so available there, who actually thought they'd made it as teenagers, thought, oh, I've discovered this. And then when they got some books, oh, somebody's found that before. You know, and so these things do, they're just there and people discover them. So it could have been an independent discovery. But the most troubling thing is that it could have been, he might not have had anything to do with it at all.
Well, he could have gone and found it and brought it back and claimed it.
He could have claimed it. Yes, that's right. Some people thought he was a charlatan. So, yes, he could have. So we don't know. I've tried to put all the different evidence in the book and come to my own conclusions, but left it to readers to come to their own. It's not going to be settled anytime soon. But I think what's actually very interesting, too, about the Pythagoreans, now that's his people, we're talking about the Mathematici and all that, is the some of the ideas they did come up with, which are very far, brilliantly ahead of their time, such as the fact that in their cosmology, the Earth was not the immovable center of everything. It was in orbit. The Earth is in orbit around the central fire, as they called it. And they arrived at that, though, in a way that seems off the wall to us, because they had discovered in musical ratios, the ratios using the numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4, and they concluded that there must be something really special about those numbers, and when you add them together, you get 10. So they thought it was a 10-body cosmos. And they couldn't see 10 bodies up there in the sky any more than we can, but they posited something called a counter-Earth, which was like the Earth and probably with people on it, they thought, but positioned in a way that it will never be able to see it from Earth. And Earth and counter-Earth and Sun and Moon and everything else moon orbits the Earth, but everything else orbited the central fire. And the Sun and the Moon reflected the light of the central fire to the other planets, and that's where we get the light. And the other part of that, which is way ahead of its time, was the realization. We really do think they were the first people probably to have realized this, that what we see as the apparent movement, heavenly movement in the sky, is a combination of opposite movements, and also that it's the movement of the Earth itself that creates part of that apparent movement. That was, when you think about things like that, they seem so brilliantly ahead of their time and so, out of the envelope for that that day and time. And at the same time, so misled to have gotten that out of, 1, 2, 3, 4.
So one of the other ideas, I want to talk now about some of the post-Pythagoreans. And you've raised some of these other ideas. So one of those is the idea of the music of the spheres. So we'll leap right over Plato and come up much closer to the present day and talk a little bit perhaps about Johannes Kepler.
Yes.
Because that is clearly one of the things that sort of preoccupied him. So let's talk about how Pythagoras influenced Kepler.
Well, I think I like to think of Kepler as probably the most Pythagorean person after Pythagoras himself. Because Kepler had this strong belief that the universe had to follow harmonious mathematical laws. He believed that's the way God created the universe. His big aims in his life, his big goals, were discovering what reasoning God had used in creating the universe. That was one of his goals. And he was sure that it was harmonious and symmetrical and all connected with a unity to it. And it was that was just at the core of Kepler's thinking. And that arguably was just as instrumental as his rigorous mathematics and Tycho Brahe's splendid data in allowing him to discover that the planetary orbits are elliptical rather than round. And then, of course, later on, he did follow up so devotedly on the idea of the music of the spheres. And out of that idea, which most of us today think, it's a lovely poetic idea, but that's as far as it goes. And that's really what we've thought ever since Kepler. But out of that idea, emerged his third law of planetary motion. It's really amazing. I love the one quotation. I don't know if I can give it directly from Kepler, but he was so devoted to this idea that things had to be orderly and geometrical that when he was working on the orbits of Mars, just as he was writing Astronomia Nova, he at one point wrote about God. Heretofore, we have not found such ungeometric work in any of his other works. So he was criticizing an academic colleague. But yes, he was really devoted to that. And we still are. Now, that's the interesting thing, how much of that, of the Pythagorean thinking still underlies the scientific method.
And you've mentioned that it sort of continues right up to the modern day. And to finish off, perhaps let's have a quick look at you. You talk a little in the book about Bertrand Russell and Russell's struggle with Pythagorean ideas. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's interesting because he, first of all, he said that he could not think of any other figure who had had as great an influence on human thought, on the sphere of thought, as he put it, as Pythagoras. And he thought of Pythagoras as the founding father of the whole line of mathematics that resulted in modern mathematics, including his own.
Mm-hmm.
But he lamented that the Pythagoreans also had had what he called a mystical side to their teaching, in which numbers were something people discovered, or mathematics were something discovered by human beings rather than invented by human beings. And he thought that had influenced Plato to introduce the forms. And there, he said, the whole inheritance went sour. Because here was a realm of, here was a view of mathematics as a realm that from which sense-based knowledge and empirical knowledge would always fall short. And for that reason, he called Pythagoras the serpent in the philosophical paradise. So you can tell he was of two minds. He also lived before the discovery of that the Pythagorean theorem was not really Pythagoras's. So he attributed quite, well, you know, rightly to Pythagoras at that time. He died in, I think, 1980, did he? Mm-hmm. That late?
We're out of time. So I've been talking to Kitty Ferguson about her book Pythagoras, His Lives and the Legacy of a Rational Universe. Kitty, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.